the Crude Life Media Network. We have many different brands. We also like to thank everybody on our social media network, 500,000 followers we have between the Bakken, the Eagleford, the Permian, the Niobrara Chalk, the Haynesville. I know I'm leaving a couple out, the Marcellus. So thank you very much for joining us. We're located, of course, in North Dakota. That's why we do the weekly Bakken get-together. We have Public Service Commissioner Randy Crispin with us today, and we're going to do kind of two interviews with him. One, he's going to wear his public service hat, which he has to wear every single day. He's also a farmer rancher, so he brings that perspective. But also, he's just announced he's going to be running for re-election. I see no reason why he won't win. He's got a past of good record, and he's in the Republican Party, which has a very good re-election rate. And he's an incumbent. And I think incumbents have a 92.7 re-election rate in this country, which is higher than the post-Soviets. Politburo, which was 87%. But I joke about that a little bit. So one of the things we wanted to talk about today, before we went on the air, we were talking about reinvention of business plans, reinvention of business models. And I know I've talked about this in the past, which is John Gibson, former chairman of One Oak, and Harold Hamm, who's with Continental Resources, James Volker with Whiting, all told me through interviews that they were rewriting their business plan, essentially rewriting their entire business plan because of hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling. The combination and the success of the innovation of technology completely made them rewrite. That's why they say we're not about slinging chains anymore, and we have so many white-collar people on the drill sites now. But so what we did in the media, we had to reinvent our business model, just like everybody else. If you're in a company in an industry right now, it's out of oil and gas and the media, I'm telling you right now, you're going to have to reinvent your business model. Because for one, oil and gas is one of the kings of the economy, and when they rewrite, you're going to have to. It all ripples. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely.
It all ripples through. And so we saw it in the Bakken firsthand with the Bakken ripple of the economic. And then we saw the inner ripple, which when it kind of the downturn came, we saw the ripple come back in. And the same thing happens through the logistics of a business plan. And so we were talking with the media and how you're now entering into a candidacy race.
Yep.
So you have to pay attention to that stuff because, you know, you in the, today's media, you don't know who's friend or foe. You don't know who's TMZ and who's Walter Cronkite and who's, you know, so that's a whole different layer of what you're used to. And we were kind of joking a little bit that there's almost a new market for journalism again, to where a lot of energy news, for example, we were talking about that. But you can go to any industry. You go to almost any industry. And so much just flat-out news is politicized now. There used to be a time when everybody could agree that this was a sheet of paper. Well, now it's like somebody has to say, well, it's not really a sheet of paper. It's, you know, it's a bunch of trees that were, you know, burned up. You know, they gotta put some political spin in it. And so very long introduction, and I do apologize. So how are you today? Let's start with the how are you.
I'm doing just fine. We're having a lot of good things happen at the PSC. The political campaign is off to a good start, and you bring up some interesting topics on technology, and you talked about oil and gas or energy, the media. You know, my former life, which I still like to dabble in a little bit on the weekends, was ranching, and you know the agriculture industry is also changing mm-hmm. just as fast. Whether it's you know different equipment, different grazing techniques, different marketing techniques, better use of genetics. So I don't think there's anything in the world that isn't changing quickly in this age that we live in.
Are you seeing that blend in that? I mean, you know, in energy, we're talking ag and energy had to go hand in hand through the land, through land. Okay. Now, with some of the drones and the UAS technology, I do see another relationship forging. For example, precision agriculture. Well, so much of the energy and ag went hand in hand, whether it's counting cattle or whether it's checking to see if the potato has blight on it, for example. I was talking with Kevin Lear with the North Dakota Buffalo Association, the Bison Group, and they're using drones to count buffalo now. I can see a day where the energy and ag will use each other's aerial view to check pipeline monitoring. You know what I mean? So are you seeing any emergence coming on your end from the PSC or even from a ranching side? Or
Not a lot in the parts of the energy industry that we're working on, but you sure can see that it's on the way. Mm-hmm. Because you're correct, drones are starting to play a bigger and bigger role in agriculture, and they certainly are in the energy industry. One example is a lot of the pipelines that are jurisdictional to us, they have to be checked 26 times a year, so the assumption is it's every other week. Of course, there's going to be a weather delay or something like that occasionally. So in many cases, it's a requirement of 26 times a year, no more than 3 weeks apart.
Okay.
And you know that they are moving already toward doing that with drones, as opposed to having a pilot and a photographer or an observer flying all those miles of pipelines every time at fairly low levels. It's not exactly even the safest type of flight. It's a very a flight that requires a lot of training and focus, because you need to fly low to be keeping an eye on it. Mm-hmm. Well, when you can do that without people up there and just send the drone over, so they're using it, it's going to continue on. And yes, certainly the same aerial views that check to see whether there was any evidence of a underground pipeline leak could also be used to be checking the farmers' crops too. And so I'm certain that as we go, you're going to see more and more of a merger there.
I do too, and I think what I've noticed anyway is that the technology milestones, they're leaps, they're not steps. And when they can layer in so much of that data, it is, you take these huge leaps. And so like I could, you know, a couple of years ago, I remember sitting in Bismarck, and it was Petroleum Council was there, and I think Lynn Helms was there, and they were talking about getting a grant, and they were hiring a crop duster to check pipelines. And I thought, wow, we are really behind the times here. Well, then the next year, they started integrating into drones. Well, that's a quick leap. That's a huge leap, is what I'm saying. That, so it was, to me, it was kind of like when back in the publishing days when I first got in the magazine business, we used to lay out the magazine by hand with tape and on light boards. Well, then the next year came the digital revolution. I'm really glad I got to do the old way, because then it made me appreciate and understand the new digital way. And I think that's kind of what happened with a lot of the drone stuff. We become more appreciative of the drones because the precision that it can bring. I mean, I don't know about you, Randy, but I would think a pilot is more concerned about his safety in the air than checking pipelines.
And you know, one of the ways that we're using it right now at the PSC and the legislative session last year in 2017 did allow us, we were able to buy a drone for our coal mine reclamation team.
Oh.
And, you know, it is a huge time saver for us and also a safety feature, because a lot of people don't realize anymore, but a big part of our agency is the coal mine reclamation. We go out and do hands-on inspections, look at how they're handling topsoil, for instance, and make sure it's not eroding. Look at how reseeded land is taking off. Look at their sediment ponds, making sure there's not erosion. Well, if the feature that the inspector wants to check is 3/4 of a mile away and over the top of a big hill, and there's some rough terrain in there, we used to send them out on ATVs or sometimes with pickup trucks or something to go out and visually check that to make sure that everything mm-hmm. is being done appropriately. Now we can send a drone over there and get a picture and find out just as easily. We don't have to send our people out in rough terrain on ATVs and such. So they are increasingly playing a big role in getting the work done efficiently and, I think, more importantly, safely.
So I'm going to ask you about leadership. One of the things that we were talking about is the reinvention of business plans. And then I've asked this to Senator Hoeven, as well as Governor Burgum, Lynn Helms, several others. Since there's so much reinvention going on with business plans, and whether you can look at it as a leader is an industry or not, because I look at it as they are. I mean, most times a leader in an organization stays a leader in other organizations, if not their own, for their life. And you take a look at some politicians, and you know, they're 30, 40 years in office. So it's almost like leadership can become an industry for a lot of different people. With that being said, I'm on record saying I think leaders need to reinvent their business plan right now. What do you make of that? Do you think, you know, you're a politician, you're a leader, you're a public service commissioner. Do you think that people should be reinventing how they lead or how they communicate or how they digest, how the standard way of leading is? Do you think, you know, do you understand what I mean by that?
I do, and I think people are really forced to. I think the people who don't evolve and continue moving forward, making those changes, in the current environment that we've seen in the last decade or so, are not going to stay in office long. And mm-hmm. and so you need to be making those changes. I know at the commission, even just in 5 years and a month now that I've been there, there's been a lot of changes. And if you look at the chart of people we have there, we have slightly less people than we had when I started.
Wow.
But we have a number of people who are doing things that weren't being done 5 years ago. And some of the things that we used to be doing are no longer filled.
Mm-hmm.
And so the number has stayed pretty close, although it has lessened. But there are a lot of changes that have occurred over there in 5 years, and you need to. As we talked about before, with all the technology, the way the people that we work with at the commission, the way things are changing, as soon as we start standing still, we're going to be falling behind. So we have made sure that that's not happening.
And one of the things in oil and gas right now that's going on is there's, and other industries too, succession planning. And you're talking about leadership. Well, succession planning is all about instilling proper leadership. And Steve Swantek with Gate City Bank, he came out not too long ago and kind of reminded everybody that his retirement's coming up in 2020, and so he's got to start his succession plan now. Oil and gas, they have the same thing going on where like 70% of the industry is retiring over the next 5 to 10 years. And they're a little concerned about, say, the millennials or the Generation Xers on, are you going to respect the industry that we've just created? And so I look at the succession planning. I look at, you know, how we communicate and how we've actually educated even our younger people to where some places don't even teach handwriting anymore. So that's how I look at the reinvention of leadership. Technology has become such a disruptor. I know Governor Burgum likes to use that term a lot, disruptor, but he's right. It's disrupted the way we teach, disrupted the way we communicate. In fact, I still have a flip phone on purpose, just because I don't want to go to that handheld yet. And I got to switch because some guy took a picture of me, like a museum type thing. Not like an encouragement, like, hey, look at this. This guy's still got a flip phone. So what do you think about that and how to have the generation that's going to be retiring over the next 5 to 10 years, how do they do the succession planning or the communication to that younger generation?
You know, it's interesting because it's something that maybe I didn't give a lot of thought to until I came to the commission. I was ranching and my succession plan was, you know, getting through the next year, right? There's no 401ks or retirement plans on the ranch. You just take care of yourself and try and get through another year.
How many calves did we have this spring?
Yep. Yeah. And what are they going to be worth? So I come on to the commission and one of the first things that I observed, but I had worked with them through the legislature, and so I knew that there were a lot of people who had come on in similar time frame. We're facing quite a few retirements in the next few years, and that's no surprise or anything, and it's the same reality that a lot of the industries we work with are facing. And so that was one of my immediate concerns. It has been thrilling to see, as we've started some of that turnover process, that the young millennials, there are some fantastic people in that age demographic. Mm-hmm. It's not just the ones that you read about in the paper getting in trouble. There are all-star young folks, and you know, some of our newest hires who are, you know, very young, come in, and they not only have the skill set to do the job they were hired to do, but they seem to quickly be able to understand what everybody else in the agency is doing as well, because they have that ability to learn through all the ways that, all the avenues that mm-hmm. that modern technology provides us to learn from. And so some of our all-stars are some of our youngest employees too. So there's good folks coming up. And I know you said you wanted to talk about the campaign more later separately, but
integrated
the two kind of incorporate. I did my announcement last week and was in Fargo and spoke to college Republicans last night as far as Republican district conventions. It was in Grand Forks and so another town with some younger people, and there were a bunch of college students there. Any one of those, you would just hope that at some point you have an opening in your agency that they're going to fit in and that they might be interested mm-hmm. in your opening as their career path, because there are some fantastic young folks coming up.
You know, you mentioned that you made the announcement on the east side of the state. And I've said before in this program and many others, and this is no secret, that the majority of the population, if you draw a line probably through Valley City, it used to be Jamestown, but probably Valley City now, north-south, that's 55% of the population is east of Valley City. The cowboys, oilmen, sodbusters, ranchers, we were hoping that the east versus west argument would go away, you know, that sort of thing, especially with the oil boom, because that really connected the state like no other industry has in the past. Ranching did a little bit, but you still had ranchers and crop people, you know, farmers type yep. thing. So there was that kind of that little bit of the bravado, rubbing each other and that sort of thing. Talk to me about the East-West Connect here a little bit from the power side of things. I mean, your East-West Connect goes down to Minneapolis with XL Energy a lot of times, so you go really far east. The world of energy has connected the university system. It has connected Fargo either through Fargo Tank or whatever is servicing the oil company. You can go up to R&R Industries up in Grand Forks, just to name a couple there. Talk to me about the East-West Connect and how important it is that the state understands how they need to be symbiotic and they need to coexist. Do you know what I mean by that? Because there is that Hatfield-McCoy from time to time with East versus West. I thought we were over it, but then a few months ago, the Wall Street Journal comes out with this story where it's a bunch of East versus West stuff. And so I wanted to bring that up and just say, what can we do not to perpetuate that, but to remind people that's long gone. That's old. That's where we've reinvented ourselves as leaderships, and here's how to think. So,
you know, it should be long gone, and the reality is in my time in the legislature, and I was in the Senate for 18 years, those kinds of battles erupted when I first came in. They had been going on a long time before that. They continue today in all kinds of walks of life that happens. But I really look at those as more like the kinds of battles that erupt within a family from time to time. You have really more than a couple people, and there's going to be little power plays and, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. It's just sort of the human nature. I think in North Dakota, the people in the West understand that our food that we produce, the energy we produce, doesn't really do us much good if we don't have a population base to sell it to. And so we need this population base down there. I think the people in the East recognize that they need the things that are produced in the West to keep the activity that causes this population to be here mm-hmm. going. And so, yeah, we might have our little spats when it's just us, but when I go to any national conference, and there's a national organization of utility regulators, for instance, we also have regional transmission organizations that our utilities are part of, and as commissioners, we end up being part of the oversight of those regional utility organizations, or transmission organizations, rather. So you get out of state and you start talking to utility regulators from other states, or in my older days, to legislators from other states, and you see really how united we are here. It's easy to find the little things that we might squabble over, but really North Dakota, I think, has a pretty solid view on the world. And, you know, compared to what you get if you compare North Dakotans in general mm-hmm. to either of the coasts, we are, I think, a pretty strong culture as North Dakota, as opposed to two cultures, Eastern and Western North Dakota.
I know in the state a lot of times over the past decade, specifically the last 5 years, we've talked about as a state being very business-friendly, climate, et cetera. One of the challenges by North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, as well as Lynn Helms to a certain degree, is these big natural gas projects that need to come online for the Bakken to take that next big step. One Oak, Hess, Targa, they just announced in the past probably month and a half, these projects are on the books. Have you heard anything at the PSC, or is it we still in press release mode, you know? But you know what I mean? There's two major natural gas projects that were just announced in the last month. So where are we at with those?
Yeah, it is moving forward. And just to kind of start at the basics, you know, the natural gas just kind of comes as a byproduct of the oil almost. Very little of it is actually pursued. It comes with the oil, and it ought not be wasted. And so some years ago, the Industrial Commission put a goal for them to get to flaring no more than 15% of that. And I think that continues to ratchet down in future years. They're kind of right on the bubble. A lot of investment has gone into the oil patch in order to capture that gas. But then once you capture it, you have to do something with it. So that involves processing plants. They're very expensive. Then once it's processed, you have to ship the product somewhere where it's going to be used. And so these things don't just happen overnight, and there's rights of way to acquire and all those things. So they don't happen overnight, and they don't happen without a great deal of cost. So they've made progress. They're right on the bubble at that 15% flaring level. But as things continue to progress, and unless you look at just the most dismal projections, this is going to be a oil and gas play that is going to continue to grow. And so there is a strong demand for a lot more natural gas pipelines and processing facilities. So what we have going right now is there are sited natural gas processing plants. If they're sited already, they can do their expansions, and it doesn't really involve us so much. We have three that we're aware of that are looking at big projects. Two of them are small, non-jurisdictional plants, and they want to add on facilities that would bring them over the threshold. So we have applications for new siting for two of those. One is the Targa, and actually that hearing is next Thursday, and the commission worked very hard to juggle schedules around and get that hearing moved up. The next alternative date was in late March, and in hopes that if everything is in order, that could proceed for them, because they would like to start as early as possible and take advantage of summer construction time. So it's one of the things that I feel is important as a regulator. If we can, whatever our decision ultimately is, we want to get to it as quickly as possible. And so we did a lot of change and got that hearing date moved up. Then there's the Hess plant that you mentioned. We've not gotten an application on that, but it seems very familiar to a processing plant that we cited a couple years ago already, and frankly I'm pretty sure it's the same thing. And they had put it on hold, and now they're announcing this, but we haven't confirmed that. Maybe they've made a bunch of changes that will require a new hearing process, so not really sure of that. And then One Oak has an expansion of a facility that again is there's a small facility there. It's non-jurisdictional, so it didn't require siting, but what they want to add to it would in fact require the whole siting process. We have that application. That's a little further out yet.
Okay.
Then there's also pipelines in the play too that are going to be needed to hook these things together. To once it's processed, well, then you have your liquid products and your gas, and all that has to go somewhere. So those are in most cases those are separate siting projects then.
So they got to site the building, and then once the building's sited, they got to come back and say, now we got to transport it, so we got to site the pipelines now.
And you know, sometimes those are done in conjunction with one another. If one company is doing both things, they come in and do them all together. But sometimes you could be building something and relying on someone else to do contract shipping, and so the pipeline application might come from elsewhere.
So I'm going to ask you about coal. Just a couple more questions here. I was going to ask you, Cole, because that is a topic that is going to be more and more involved with oil and gas, mostly natural gas, of course. They're trying to integrate those energies a little bit more. And what, 90% of the state's powered by coal, something like that, 95 probably? I don't know. Who knows? A lot. What's going on with coal? For a while there, it certainly seemed anyways that there was an agenda to shut coal down, which I found very odd because the amount of money that we've put into ethanol and wind and solar, man, they got some really good clean coal technologies going. I mean, imagine if we invested half of that into coal, I mean, with the abundance of coal. Sorry, I didn't mean to soapbox there for a second, but what's going on with coal? Because I don't think people understand how important coal is.
Well, I think it's a lot of times confusing because there's really two answers to that. If you're talking about coal nationally, it's a completely different answer than when you're talking about North Dakota lignite coal.
That's true. That is,
and
true.
It's just two completely different ball games. Nationally, most of our coal is a much better coal, much better quality coal. However, it's nowhere near population centers, and so it has to be transported all over the country, and at that point, it becomes far less efficient. That coal, nationally, primarily Wyoming and Montana, mm-hmm. but also Pennsylvania, West Virginia, that is declining rapidly and would be declining much more rapidly, except for they are shipping quite a bit more overseas. The countries that point to us as putting up too much CO2 into the atmosphere are buying our coal and building power plants and becoming more efficient manufacturers than us in some cases. Now, North Dakota coal is really a different answer. It's a less quality coal, and because of that, years ago, it was already seen that you can't afford to ship this stuff all over the country. So in order to make it work, years ago, they built this model where you build the power plant right by the coal mine and build electric transmission lines to get the power out, as opposed to railing coal to mm-hmm. the population center. So we have a network of electric transmission lines, we have our coal plants, and they are so efficient because you're not railing coal all over the country that when it comes to baseload power, and I, in most conversations, add nuclear in with the coal because those, as well as some baseload natural gas plants that are in existence that are built in a way that they're made to chug along almost just 24/7. So among those, the coal is probably the most efficient there is. And so North Dakota has not seen the big decline. We've had one plant closure. I don't think you're going to see a lot more. However, these plants are being pushed into operating almost like a peaking plant where they're ramping up and down. Now, they can't ramp up and down from zero to full throttle like a real peaking plant, but we have plants that were built to run at a very high capacity, maybe no less than 70 or 80%, that are running at 40 or 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually, it's bad for our emissions, because per unit of electricity produced, you're putting out more emissions than if you were running them full speed ahead all the time. It's also poor for their efficiency. They're paying the same people, and so it drives up their costs a little more each time you throttle them back. And so it is a problem for them. It's adding to the cost of the electricity that we buy as consumers. But the fact of the matter is, as we add more renewables to the system, they're using a lot of the same transmission lines, and the power is purchased by the utility providers off the grid at the variable cost. And at any given moment, if the wind is blowing well, that's the lowest cost because there is no fuel there. And so at that point, the power plant doesn't make any money.
Right.
And so they're in a struggle. But like I say, we've had the one shut down, and I don't anticipate more coming quickly. We have a couple of quite old plants that I expect are probably not going to be there in the very long haul, in, you know, 30 or 40 years.
Are they talking about natural gas will be able to help coal quite a bit? Because I know Tony Clark was telling me a few years ago that they're just tied at the hip now. they have to be for either base load or whatever they or supplement. But
well, the natural gas, you know, you really have two types of natural gas plants. You mm-hmm. have peaking plants and you have base load plants. All the natural gas that we have added in North Dakota are peaking plants. We don't have a base load natural gas plant here. So they have not displaced any coal themselves. However, the natural gas peaking plants that have been built here basically go hand in hand with the wind.
Okay.
When the wind's not blowing, so they ramp those up quickly and thus continue to provide the power that's needed with natural gas instead of wind.
So the way they're using natural gas with coal plants nationally, we're using them for wind here.
We're matching them up with wind.
In theory.
In like the eastern part of the country, the, mm-hmm. the problems that Pennsylvania coal and West Virginia coal are having, that's a different thing. In those states, they are building baseload natural gas plants.
Okay.
And you know, a lot of your viewers and listeners, it's complex, but they need to understand there's a difference in these natural gas plants. A baseload plant is more like a coal plant, or I think that some of the people understand it, more like a diesel engine. Mm-hmm. It's made to be brought up to speed, run at pretty much full power, and just go hour after hour, day after day, just for an occasional maintenance. The peaking plants, they're made to ramp up and down in just a couple minutes' notice. However, the electricity you buy from a peaking plant is much more expensive than from a baseload plant.
Right.
And so you don't want your peaking plant. You want them to be there, but you hope that they're seldom used.
Mm-hmm. Campaign's coming around the corner. What do you got coming? What are you running on in terms of energy and PSC? I mean, what's broke? What needs fixed? And what doesn't need to be fixed from the PSC? You spent some time there, so you should kind of know what you want to fix and what you don't want to fix.
I have, and, you know, when I ran for this job in 2012, I kind of got into this because, again, your viewers and listeners should know, when I was in the Senate, I was from out in coal country and out in the energy patch. And I used to hear from a lot of people in 2012, and also you got to turn the clock back, two of our three public service commissioners were leaving that year. It was pretty well known that we were going to lose one to the Congress and one to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Tony Clark, mm-hmm. that you mentioned earlier, was leaving. And there was a lot of concern with regulations coming out of the Obama administration, and there was concern that if the Democrats took control of the PSC, that they would probably turn it into another EPA. And I said, elect me, and I'll make sure that the Public Service Commission is, in fact, serving the public. And it's what I continue to promote. And so what do I mean by serving the public? To me, it's making sure that consumers are getting reliable service from regulated monopolies, your electric and gas service, for instance. And I feel good about what we've achieved there. Our residential electric and gas rates in North Dakota are among the cheapest in the nation. By serving the public, I meant our safety programs are well run. You know, we have a rail safety program, gas pipeline safety program. I consider our weights and measures program, where we make sure that commercial scales and gas pumps and everything are accurate, so that when you buy a gallon of gas, you get a gallon of gas. Those kinds of programs that we do are efficient, they're effective, we're getting the job done for the people. I felt that serving the public means making sure that the coal mine lands are restored so that they're productive and beautiful again. I think our coal reclamation program in North Dakota is the best state program in the nation. We're continually praised by the federal mine reclamation people for the work that we do, the new techniques we develop with online applications and the drone system that I talked about, all kinds of things. Feel good about that. One of the things I'm really pushing is North Dakota has worked for almost a half a century to build this really good mine reclamation program. I want to make sure we're doing the same things for wind farms. Someday, they can talk about refurbishing these wind turbines, but someday everything becomes obsolete. Whether it's 10 years, 40 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, I don't know what it is, but they're going to become obsolete. And some future generation shouldn't have to deal with hundreds of thousands of acres of obsolete wind turbines and then still have the expense of keeping them lit up so that aircraft don't hit them. Mm-hmm. So that's something I really have been working on. But just like the coal reclamation program took decades to build, this isn't going to go quickly either. So I want to keep working on that. And probably lastly, and one of the things that you talk a lot about, the other energy industry, the oil and gas and that sort of thing, a big part of our work in these last 5 years, and I expect in the next 6 or 7 years, is the siting of that other energy infrastructure that's jurisdictional to the PSC. It's important to me as a rancher to make sure that when we're siting these things, that the will and the rights of landowners are respected. It's our job when we're siting these things to make sure that the environment and cultural resources are taken care of. I want to make sure that we're doing our part to see that North Dakota's economy is growing, and these projects certainly provide growth. I want America's energy system to be more independent of the rest of the world. We're accomplishing that. I feel good about this statistic. In the 5 years I've been on the commission, we have approved, through a long, complex process, $8.5 billion worth of energy infrastructure. That's almost $150 million per month average. Those are all projects that were thoroughly vetted to make sure they met all of the requirements regarding cultural resources and the environment and the landowners and local political subdivisions. I'm feeling good about that. Want to continue doing it for 6 more years.
$8.5 billion of approved energy infrastructure.
In 5 years.
And there's more to come.
A lot more on our table.
That is a unbelievable number, really, when you think about it. You know.
In fact, the three gas plants that we just talked about a few minutes ago,
yep,
together probably are another well over $400 million, maybe $500 million, just those three projects. And not counting the pipelines that go
right
with them or anything else.
And I was going to say, there's some infrastructure that you don't cite, that it falls under certain jurisdiction, and you know, on local levels and everything along those lines. So that's incredible. I really do believe that the future is looking really bright for energy. I know that's a cliche, but wow, when I look at the Bakken is able to produce 1 million barrels a day at $30 a barrel, and everybody's talking about the downturn, and I'm going, we're still putting out 1 million barrels a day. Yeah, it's not the Bakken boom like we thought it was, but we're still putting out 1 million barrels a day. That's good news, people, because you don't want to stop the flow. That was the one thing I know Lynn Helms has told me in the past. The one thing to keep your eye on is when they have to shut the rigs down, because then there's a lag of trying to find the crews again and moving them back here, and you got to keep them busy, even if you break even, maybe even if you lose a little bit of money, to make sure that you can keep that momentum constantly going. And that's the one thing I've noticed, that we didn't lose the momentum, we kept around the million. So anyway, sorry, I get excited about this.
Anyway, it's a fun world we live in.
It is. And the part that really makes it fun is the private land ownership and just the economic opportunities that exist because of oil and gas. I've never seen such a responsible capitalist than oil and gas, in all honesty. They give back to their community. They give to their local soccer teams. They make sure that their workers have a community center for their daughter to get married in. No, it might not be the Ritz, but they'll make sure you have the bare bones. And if you want to turn it into the Ritz of the community, go ahead. That's the part I like about it, is that they're not going to give you everything. They'll give you enough to make sure that you got the bare bones. That's truly, that's like a good parent, you know? Anyway.
Yep. And one thing, you know, we talked earlier about different viewpoints in some ways between different parts of the state. One thing about what has happened in North Dakota with the expansion of the oil and gas industry in recent years, or whether it was the coal industry 40 or 50 years ago and the big expansion that happened out there. Any place in North Dakota, if you live somewhere where there are schools or roads or water or sewer, which of course means everybody, you have benefited from North Dakota's energy development.
Without a doubt. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely.
And good luck.
Thank you.